My name is Karen Hebert, and I'm here with Thomas Tilden in Anchorage. It's December 12th, 2015. So, Tom, why don't you give us first your full name, where you were born, and tell us a little bit about where you spent your earliest years?
Okay. My name is Thomas Tilden. I was born on July 27, 1953, at Connect Hospital in out there in Bristol Bay. And that's pretty much where I grew up down in the Agushik village area, and then in Dillingham, my younger years. But she had moved up to Portage quick and was sent back down to Dillingham as a boarding student, and then lived in Dillingham ever since then.
And what was Portage Creek like when you were there, and how old were you when you spent time there?
I was 10. I had just turned 10, and Portage Creek was just it used to be an old Russian outpost, post office. And they used to portage over to the Kuujjuaq River from there, so the Russians used it as a post. But prior to that, the Russians used to go all the way up to the Kaktuli River and portage over from there into Ilyamna. But one year they were going up the river, and they pulled into Portage, and because there was ice on the river, and they got frozen there, so they end up staying there the whole winter. And so that's why the Yupiks gave it a Yupik name called Uksnakhali, and that's what the post office is called now, Uksnakhali, and it means freeze up quick. And so that's where I grew up in my, I think, my forming years 10 on.
And let's talk a little bit more about that period of your childhood and your formative years, into your teens. What were the sort of activities that you did that you think most influenced your perspectives in life, and specifically also those that involved sort of resource issues in Bristol Bay?
Well, we had just moved up from Dillingham that year because was a poor fishing salmon season, and my dad was actually thinking about moving down to a place called Port Hedland or Meshick, and there was a white owl station down there, and he was promised some sort of a job down there, and so we were actually thinking about moving down there, and we went moose hunting up on the Nooshinghak River, and we had stopped at Portage, and this the tribal chief there was building the school. And my dad had asked him whether or not he had a teacher lined up already, and he said no. And dad said, "Well, you should write to the governor and ask him for a teacher." And the chief couldn't read or write, and he told my dad, he says, "You write to the governor and get me a teacher," and he says, "You could have any land around here that you want." And so that's how we ended up in Portage Creek, was that my dad wrote that letter and got a teacher, and kept on thinking about that offer, and so we eventually moved up there that year. And that was the same year that was my very first year of fishing that year, also because during that salmon season, my dad's crew member from Kodiak had a loss in their family, and so he took off and at the early part of the season, and so my dad had no partner, and so him and my mom talked, and they thought that, well, they'll let me go, so I ended up being put on the boat that year. And my dad was a very patient teacher. I mean, he really taught me how to read the compass, the fathometer, and know all the points, where all the sandbars were, where all the channels were. I mean, he really took time to teach me all that, and it was quite a learning experience. And of course, up in Portage, we lived up on a hill. You might remember packing up, I loaded myself up with like three bags of 10 pounds of flour. I almost got all the way to the top and one of them slipped. And I'd never really been scolded by my dad before, but he really scolded me because we lost that 10-pound bag of flour. And he told me how important that flour was going to be to us that winter and how little we had. And I never realized how, you know, how important food was to us. I always thought that it just appeared magically. My parents always put it on the table and we ate, you know, at that point. And so it made me really aware of what we ate. And so when I watched my dad go set snares, I went out and I learned about that too. And so I set my own snares. And I had my own snare line. And then I taught my brother, younger brother Richard. And so we would compete with who got the most rabbits. You know, because that's all we were snaring around the house was rabbits. And there was rabbits galore that year. So we felt pretty important that we contributed a lot to our dinner table because of the rabbits that we ate. You know, we had rabbits too, rabbit roasts, rabbit soup. Any way you could cook a rabbit, we found out how to cook a rabbit, you know.
It sounds like
that's what saved us, though.
It sounds like even before you started commercial fishing, you'd done a lot of subsistence fishing. Do you want to speak a little bit about that and how you came to do that?
Yeah. Subsistence fishing was always really, really important to us. And my mom had a I can remember my dad building the rack, fish rack for her. And my dad was walking it, and he thought this was okay. This looks like a good size. And my mom said, "No, bigger." And so my mom my dad walked a little bit bigger around the perimeters of where he thought the fish rack would be. No, bigger. And so by the time he got done, I mean, we had a pretty big fish rack. And so we had the tin, and we found the driftwood to make that fish rack. And we closed it in, and then it came time to make the smokehouse. And my mom had told my dad that all of the fish that were under the fish rack had to go into that smokehouse probably at the same time. So it had to be a big smokehouse too. And so so instead of a really broad smokehouse, he made a really high one with lots of layers in it so salmon could be layered inside of it. And my mom looked way up at the top of that high smokehouse and said, "You know, how am I going to get the fish all the way up there?" And so my dad had to make a ladder for her so that she could climb up and hang her fish, you know. But I can remember how that fishing came. But of course, it was my grandma that really taught me, you know, about food. And because I remember one time when we were real small and we were walking down on the beach and there was a dead seal on the that had washed up on the beach. And it was very, very old, almost totally decayed and really smelled. And I can remember as a little kid going up to it. And I was probably only about 2 years old and I was going to kick it. I said, "This stinky seal." And I was about ready to kick it. And my grandma comes running in. No. She said, no, don't kick our food. The seal lived its life and died somehow and rolled up here. But it fed other things even when it died. And it's still doing that. So you got to just leave it alone. "Oh, okay." And she said, "We always got to respect our food, wherever our food comes from, regardless of whether it's usable to us or not, it's feeding something or somebody. And so after that, I had a lot of respect for animals that I found washed up on the beach, you know. And never forgot that. That was something that she really paid a lot of time and attention with me during that time, you know.
And did you say did she fish down at Ingushik, did you say? Yeah.
Yeah, she had a sentient site down there, she had a commercial site. And of course, fish rack and smoke house. Everybody had fish racks and smoke house because that was the time to put up the fish.
Mm-hmm.
So we put up a lot of fish for us to eat during the winter time. And then, of course, we had dog teams.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to figure a fish a day for every dog team that you had. And then you had a paddock with about about 30 days more of fish, because when people come to visit you, you had to feed their dogs,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we put up thousands of fish.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it was only after we put up the fish that we saved for ourselves. You know, it was the lake run,
mm-hmm.
lake run of salmon, which happened to be chums. And so we called it dogfish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's how the people call it dogs now. You know, but that was the fish that we put up for our dog teams.
And your grandmother sold some of those fish too to the canneries, or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a set net, and every period, the cannery had a truck on the beach there. They'd come to every site and peel every fish on board. Throw every fish on board your truck, and they give you a slip of paper telling you how much fish they took from you. And then back then, of course, we were paid per fish. It wasn't until the 70s that we were finally paid by the pound.
And so maybe you can tell us a bit more about how you first sort of came to be involved in work on resource issues in Bristol Bay.
I think by accident. I really think by accident, because I had, I was a proofreader for the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, and so I was proofreading about all of this offshore oil and Bristol Bay area plan, resource plan, and back then, of course, there was in order to duplicate something, you had to put little sheets of ink paper in between sheets, and so the secretaries, before they pulled those ink sheets out, they wanted to make sure that everything, all the spelling was right and the lines were all perfect. So I have a desk close to them. They always used to use me all the time, so I sit there and proofread.
So what year about is this that you?
That was 72.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
I did that. But prior to that, though, you know, in the village, our village council was very traditional. They had a tribal chief and second chief, third chief, and their meetings basically involved everybody, because we'd have a big potluck. And that's how they met. That's how they meet. Because we'd have this potluck, and then they'd talk about some issues that came up. And we had people from Dillingham come up to our village one time, and they were talking about the Land Claim Settlement Act and protecting our resources, you know. And of course, in our village, we saw hardly anybody. There was hardly anybody that came to our village, except the pilots that were going through, or people that were motoring up the river.
So this is in Portage Creek now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so we really didn't see what they were talking about. You know, the influence of people coming in, and affecting the resources there. Except that during moose season, all these people from Dilda would come up, and all these sport hunters would come up, and then we would see that wow, we've got to get our moose before these guys come up, mm-hmm. you know, and that's the way our village was. We knew when they were going to come up, and so we really didn't have to scramble for moose. Because those guys were run by seasons, and we weren't. We ran by need. You know, we were different. We were totally different than them. Of course, they told us that we were illegal. but to us, it wasn't. It was just, you know, timing. We were going to get our moose anyway. But I can remember that one meeting that they came up and they were talking about the need for a land-time settlement. I remember we all asked questions, and we were all kind of super confused because we didn't see any resource issues, or we didn't see any conflict between these groups. Mm-hmm. And the chief, when he spoke, you know, he said, why are you guys muddying the waters? You know, we don't have no problems up here. Mm-hmm. And we really meant that, because we really didn't see it. But I can remember the people from Dolan being kind of upset because they said it was happening all around us, mm-hmm. you know, but we didn't see the population. And we were a small village, we didn't see no population issues up there, except during moose season. Mm-hmm.
You know. And then how did, it sounds like you must have moved from Portage eventually to Dillingham, if you were in Dillingham in the early 70s, mm-hmm. how did land claims then change the Bristol Bay region?
When we moved to, I had to go to high school because our school only went to 8th grade. Mm-hmm. And then I had an option of going to Oregon, Chamawa Indian School down there, or Chalaco Indian School in Oklahoma, or Dillingham, which was had a boarding home student. As a boarding home student, I stayed living in someone's home. And so that's what I chose. I decided to do that. And so I went back down to Dillingham. Dillingham was a small little town, 600 people. And that's how I got down there. And people lived differently in Dillingham. To me, of course, it was a big city, but they lived differently, they act differently, and they didn't really depend on the resource like we did out in the village. They bought stuff from the store. You know, it was a totally different concept to me, and it was kind of like a different world. And it was also wasteful. You know, I can remember thinking, how, boy, these guys, they don't eat hoofs, they don't eat this product in the bones, and they don't eat this and that, and it was different. Yeah, they didn't eat the food that we ate, you know. But it was interesting anyway, to notice that difference.
So you mentioned before that you first started hearing about potential oil and gas development when you were working for the, was it the BB&C or the BB&A?
Mm-hmm. BB&C.
BB&C. Mm-hmm. And so how did that influence your perspectives and the way that you eventually were to get involved in a lot of local issues and organizations?
I think when I was proofreading those letters, and a lot of them were actually explaining our dependence on the fishing game, and I thought that's absolutely right. That it's really important, all these resources to us, because at that time we were at a low end of salmon coming into the bay. There was years that we barely met the statement, and that's why we were kind of poor back in the 60s. But of course, I didn't know really think about that, us as being poor, but the salmon runs are real small, and so we hardly had any takeaway. Of course, there was enough for subsistence and for our dogs, but there wasn't enough for buying new things, like clothes and food and stuff like that. And so most of the families at that time were in the hole with canneries or stores. Back then they used to let you charge. And and of course I realized that, I think, when I dropped that bag of flour. And then my dad had explained to me about, you know, how much he was in debt and how he couldn't really get any more, add any more to that debt. And so I knew that resources that we got off the land up there in Portage and down there in Nagusik were very important to us, was what we ate. And so, yeah, I wanted to protect them, and I saw that's the intent of the letters that was going out to these public officials, that how important these resources were to us. And so I sensed that, I felt that. So with the people from the state government and the oil companies came to our area, and I listened to them, I watched those people, because I didn't know them, you know, but I watched them. And of course, the first thing that really stuck out to me was their clothing. Their clothing was different. You know, it wasn't rough and tough jeans that we had. You know, they had different kind of pants on, they had different kind of shirts on, you know. And then when they started talking about their oil and gas, you know, and kind of our needs were kind of second to them. I was kind of shocked. Now, how could these people feel that way about our food, our resources, that they really don't care? It was kind of obvious, you know, in the meetings that the only thing they were pursuing was their oil and gas. So I noticed that, and that's how I really got involved, you know, because a lot of the old timers, particularly from the village at that time, couldn't speak English, mm-hmm. you know, and they had a hard time saying what they meant and felt. And so I kind of filled that gap for them. You know, that's how I really got into this, all of this, I think, was that even though my speaking and knowing the Yupik language was very limited at the time, I could still feel what they were feeling and what they were trying to get across. And so that's how I really think I got involved. Was listening to the elders trying to portray what they were trying to say.
And so what were the first sort of involvements in local organizations that you participated in?
I really can't remember. I just remember a meeting, you know, down at the old movie theater in Dillingham, and going down there because I knew the date. Mm-hmm. I knew the date because I had read these letters, and so I went down there just as an individual, mm-hmm. you know. And then I saw that they had these other folks from the villages there, and so I attended. But of course, we gotta go farther way back when I was 5 years old, 6 years old. My dad used to take me to. Of course, he was involved in all of this stuff, and he used to take to all me to all these meetings. And to me, it was just nodding with dad. And I'd go to all these meetings, and he'd always sit me in front row, and I'd sit there, kick and play, and write and draw, and this and that. But I would always listen to what was going on in the meetings. And my dad would always check on me, and, how you doing, Tom? I'm doing good. You okay? Yeah, I'm okay. Oh, and I'd say, hey, how come that guy was shouting at that guy over there, you know? And my dad would sit there, well, this guy thinks this, and this guy thinks that, and that's how come they disagree. I said, well, why don't they do this? And my dad says, yeah, why don't they? So they called the meeting back to work. My dad would bring up what I said down there. My son, over there, you know, he's 6 years old, and he could see the difference here, and he'd come up with the solution, and this is what he said, and he says, he can think that, why can't we as adults, you know? And so that's how I got involved in meetings.
Yeah.
You know, and, as a young kid.
And what were those meetings that your dad was involved in most?
Mostly resource mm-hmm. meetings, fishing game.
Okay. So fishing and what mm-hmm. and fishing game, what kind of fishing meetings, and what were the main issues that people were debating back then?
Numbers. I mean, of course, they were talking escapement numbers. They were talking about different things about the fishery itself. And of course, back then, of course, there was a lot of meetings on prices because there was fishing unions at that time, and so a lot of discussion on fish prices and of course boundaries and things like that, because it was a new fishery, you know, because after statehood, everything had changed, you know, so it was kind of a new fishery. And so, and of course, the combine game issues back then too, and so there was a lot of hunting and caribou and of course, fishing game. Back then, I think the people were looking at those numbers, and every year they grow, you know, and so I made kind of a habit when I went out there when I was 10 years old. I would sit there and I'd count all the boats around me, around my dad's boat that when we were drifting, how many boats there were. I told my dad, he'd write it down. And then, so every year I did that. And the numbers were going up, you know. And he was concerned about the fishery. And I remember during some of those fishery union meetings, they were talking about that they have to limit how many people could fish because only so many people could make money off of this fishery. And my dad, being a former sailboat fisherman, you know. He could remember putting in 30,000-40,000 fish a season, you know. And of course, nowadays, with all our modern technology, modern boats and everything, but we've got a high number of fishermen out there. We think we catch a lot of fish when we get 20,000 fish, you know. But back then, they used to get 30,000-40,000. And so they saw the decline too, you know, from 30,000-40,000, and so of course some of the highlanders were 50,000, but they saw the numbers come down to 20, you know, and so
so that as more boats entered
mm-hmm.
the fleet,
yeah.
And so was that before or after limited entry?
Mm-hmm.
Was that before or after limited entry?
Before limited entry.
Before
limited entry. In fact, one of the things that had happened that really woke up a lot of people's eyes, I think, was what year was that? 60, I'm thinking 67 or 68, that we fished for Queen Canary. And when we went down there that spring, I think it was in 68. We went down that spring, and back then the canneries used to buy the boats for the fishermen. And there was all these new boats, you know, and we were looking at these new boats, and some of them were really good Bryant boats, 32 foot, and some of them were plywood boats. And in 68 we had a storm, and those plywood boats got washed up on those sandbars, and they lost all their, they lost the whole crew, everybody died in those boats. Three of those plywood boats end up hitting those sandbars and lost all those people, and people were looking for them. But the thing that was in everybody's mind was that fishing was growing very rapidly, and that people from the lower 48 were bringing up any kind of boat that they could to catch fish. And in Queen we saw that, and the other people saw that too, and I think that's when. And of course, my dad, who had actually numbers which I used to count,
mm-hmm.
you know, saw the increase too. And so that's when they actually started talking about limited entry back in those days, mm-hmm. about that time.
So I'd be curious to hear your reflections on, you know, what the sort of main issues have been that people in Bristol Bay are most concerned about involving natural resources, and how those have changed over time. What you see as the sort of biggest concerns in the past, and how that relates to those of more recent years.
I think we were, you know, when I look back at that time, back in the 50s, the federal government ran everything until 1960, and then the state government came in, and the federal government, under the federal government, the decisions were made in Washington, D.C. and Seattle. Seattle companies would told Washington, D.C. how many fish they wanted, and so that Washington, D.C. was going to say, okay. But we saw a steep decline in number of salmon during that year. The 60s were terrible for fish because we had to rebuild those stocks. So when the state of Alaska took over and started using science to decide how much numbers and predictions and things like that, that they finally applied those. And so we sat on the beach a few seasons, you know, with absolutely very minimal fishing, maybe king salmon season, and that was it. And so we didn't make any money. The federal government sent us food. They sent us crackers and cheese and butter. And so we had to live off the land. But they were rebuilding the salmon system back then in the 60s. It was quite a struggle. And of course, once they kicked in science to determine how much fish should go up the river and multiply and stuff, the other thing that, there was two other things that kicked in. One, there was an intercept fishing down in Area M, and those guys would just load up, regardless of how many fish were going up. So we realized that, oh wow, we got these guys too. And then washing up on our beaches was all of this tangle web and these Japanese round balls, you know, corks for them. And so we realized that, oh wow, there's people out there fishing, and people actually saw them, you know. And so there was, so that was kind of a driving thing. Was okay, let's see what we can do with RAM, then we'll work on these foreign people. So RAM was a big issue back then. And eventually it turned into focus turned on to the foreign fishermen. And boy, when we closed down the or we limited the amount of fish that the area boys could catch, that we saw increase the slice jump, things kind of smoothed out where we could actually survive out that fish we in. And then when we kicked the foreign fishermen out in 77, boy, the numbers really leaped. You know, we really saw a big difference. And so those were the issues at that time. Of course, the other thing that was going on was that gear was a big issue, because back then there was no limits on how many meshes you could have. And people were sewing two nets together, you know, and so nets were 40 feet deep, you know, and so those were minor issues compared to the two big things, so, you know, but there was always issues. Fishermen always have issues, you know.
And what about in more recent years? I mean, you also mentioned the start of limited entry and concern over, you know, sort of more boats in the fleet, and concerns about interception in the fishery. How does that compare to the issues that have been most significant, you know, for example, over the past decade, or any time in between that you've seen them? What's stayed the same, and what's been the most sort of dramatic changes, would you say?
Well, it was kind of funny that the first limited entry program that they had was that they said that they were going to limit each boat to 25 fathoms per person on board, you know, and so the local folks, they just bought license for all their kids and their wives, and the whole family was on board, and everybody was out there fishing so that they could fish 150 fathoms. And the outside fishermen came in, and they just had them and their crew member. And so they only had 50 fathoms. And it was kind of funny, because we had a lot more gear in the water for local fishermen at that time than the outside fishermen did. And of course, some of them were getting disgusted. But it was us local folks that were complaining about, oh, we almost lost our son, we almost lost our daughter, grandma fell overboard or something, you know. And it's too dangerous, we can't have that, we gotta kick the system out. And so we threw that system out and came in with this other limited entry system, you know. That first limited entry system actually gave us more permits, more people fishing but the present limited entry system is. But the good thing about that system was that we all had a by gear license, and that was one of the factors in getting a new permit. Was have you recently had a gear license? So we actually qualified for a lot of permits. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't have. And of course, but just the new system that they put in, eventually we lost, or we are losing, you know, that we become the minority in our fishery now compared to at one time we were the majority.
And in recent years, you've become, maybe not recent years, you could tell me the history of when you got involved in the leadership of the Chögyam tribe and how your tribal government has also sort of played a role in being a voice in resource concerns in recent years in Bristol Bay. Maybe you could speak a little bit more to that story.
About our tribe?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, our tribe has always worked on mostly social issues, and then there was a program by the North Pacific Management Council that said there was a couple of fighters on there that said, hey, you know, the local people are sitting on the beach watching all the Seattle boats outside catch all this modern fish, this crab and this cod and this all of this big fishery going on outside of them, and they're not participating because of only Seattleers. And so they gave us a small percentage that we could fish. And of course, first they just only gave us cod, then eventually they gave us all the other resources. But that's how our tribe got involved, because our tribe was one of the few villages that was able to qualify. And we really got involved in fisheries because that organization made us involved in. But so now we're actually looking at, you know, doing our own processing plant, you know, for our fishermen to get involved in. And so we offer our people jobs through that BBDC, Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. And so our people work there, and they also get some of the benefits because the BBDC, with their profits, they allowed us fishermen to get insulated fish holds and braillers and icing systems. And so that's been very helpful for our fishermen to get top quality fish, you know. But we do want to do our own processing eventually someday.
And in terms of, you know, debates over mining development that have been going on in Bristol Bay in recent years. How did you come to be involved in those? Maybe you could also tell us a bit about that.
In mining, it was mining. The when we first heard about the Pebble Mine in up on the Coptula River, to some of us it was a blessing in disguise. Wow, great timing. Because at that time our salmon price had dropped to 50 cents a pound. The salmon farming industry had grown really big in Chile and Norway, and they dominated the markets, and our salmon prices just crashed. And at 50 cents a pound, with all our expenses and stuff, we didn't make very much money. And so when we saw mining coming in, we thought, oh, year-round jobs and economic opportunity, or at least that's what I thought. and so we were kind of neutral on the idea. But once we started getting educated on what this all really meant, then it was like little red flags started popping up right and left. And of course, when we asked we started doing our own research, and so we'd ask these companies about, hey, what about this, you're going to use this toxic stuff to get those minerals out, and what's going to happen with all those? Oh, we'll get back to you. And they'd never get back to us, you know, and we realized that, wow, there's something really big that was going to happen to us, and we didn't really know what the outcome was going to be. And so we really had to concentrate and kind of organized around that, and formed a group called the NUMTA, and started getting the answers that the mining company would give us. Mm. You know, we started creating partnerships and relationships with other organizations that had experienced fighting these companies. It was kind of funny though, at the beginning, we kind of were overwhelmed by all these different companies coming in, or different organizations coming in and wanting to help us. And but we also watched them start, you know, putting words in our mouths and starting taking over. And we were like, no, that's not what we said. You know, we never said nothing about that. But they were doing all these press releases, and we finally had to say, no, we're going to choose who our partners are going to be after this, because it just, we felt overwhelmed by some of those big organizations outside. So, but it took a while to fine tune to people that we could trust and listen to us and would actually fight for us, you know, because otherwise, because we made some enemies on the way, they would, some of these organizations would come in and tell us that, you got to fight this mine over in this part of Alaska too, or in this country. And so we were doing all these letter writing and stuff, and then we go to our regional or statewide meetings, and then those people that we wrote letters against, they get mad at us, you know, and finally we had meetings and said, no, we're not going to do that no more. You know, we're going to focus just on our issue. We're not going to go fight other people's battles, or we're not going to do what these other people want us to do. And finally, it took a while to find who was going to help us and who was there for their agenda. You know, we finally had to settle on our agenda. But it took some time. But I think we got a good working relationship with the people we work with now.
So maybe you can reflect a bit more on what the debate over mining has meant for the region. Has it sort of changed the vision that the people in Bristol Bay have for their future and what it will be like to live in in Bristol Bay, and sort of how has it shifted in your opinion? Like, a lot of these conversations about and activities have been going on for a long time.
Well, there were some good and bad that I saw that happened. It really created some bad scars amongst our people, because there were some people that bought into that. To the mining is the best thing in the world, and they really fought hard for the mining companies, you know, and it tore families apart. I could remember going to some community meetings where elders were actually fighting amongst themselves. You know, one sister would say, oh, my grandson and my son are working for the mining company, and that's the best thing around here that ever happened to us. And then her sister or brother would say, no, you know, we got to think about the resources. We got to remember our ways, protecting the natural resources. We can't let this mining company destroy that and take that away from us, because because we've got to think longer than us and our families. And it was real difficult sitting in those meetings and watching that take place, you know. And so, on the other side, it united folks that were fighting against each other. There used to be three groups of people up there for the resources. There was the sport hunters and fishers, and then there was the commercial fishers and hunting guides, and then there was the subsistence user. And they all had their ideas of what they wanted and how much they needed and how these other people were destroying their little world. And what had happened was when the mining company came in, these three groups united. You know, they all became one. They all had a common enemy. And all of a sudden they realized that that really the differences that they had between them were small, you know, and that they could work together. And so that was a good part about that, you know. And then the other thing, I think another positive spin-off of that was that the parents were, of course, bringing their children to these meetings, and some of these kids graduated and became experts in some of the fields that we never ever dealt with before, you know. They became engineers and knew all of this stuff. So in a way, there was good and bad that came out of this, I think, stuff, you know.
So maybe in the last part of our conversation, we can follow along with these ideas and maybe speak a bit about both what. So the first question would be sort of, what are the main issues that you imagine that the region is going to face in the future? And then also for those younger folks who are starting to get involved now, what you think is most important for them to keep in mind from your experience over the past many decades sort of working on these issues in Bristol Bay?
Well, locally, it was kind of funny how ANSCA separated the lands, gave some to the regional corporations and gave some to the village corporations, and then gave all of the subsurface lands that the village corporation lands selected to the regional corporations. And so there's going to be a big fight over that, you know, down the road, you know, because the regional corporations are profit-making corporations, and they're going to have to make money, and they're going to explore, because I think the state of Alaska is really an unexplored state, and there's going to be more pebble mines discovered. We got too many mountains, we got too many volcanoes, you know, we got too many deep river systems, and stuff like that, so there's going to be a big battle between the people themselves on these resource issues. So that's something that, you know, people are going to have to watch. I think eventually someday we're going to look back at Pebble and think of how small Pebble is, even though it's a huge issue, you know. But there's going to be bigger battles on the road. So the kids got to know that's going to happen, and they're going to have to get educated, and they're going to have to make those decisions, and then but I think if they look down the road, I'll say if you look down the road 100 years from now, you know, what is Alaska going to be like? And this is something that the whole state has to look at. You know, what does the state of Alaska want to be 100 years from now? Does it want to see a whole bunch of open pit mines all around the state, pocketing on all the river systems, destroy the river systems, ecosystems in that area? Because right now the regulations that we have don't really totally protect the resources or the land or the water. And so the state of Alaska has to look at that, because when they finally pull the last drop of oil out of the ground and the last mineral out of the ground, what are we going to have left? You know, they're going to have to decide that the decision that they're going to make is going to be our last 100 years from now. And in my vision of what Alaska is going to be like 100 years from now, it's going to be that since we got so much of our land tied up in federal refuges and wildlife areas, that people are going to come to Alaska because it is the last winter, and they're going to want to come and see fish in the streams and birds in the air and game on the land. They're going to want to come to see this last winter where its natural beauty, its clean water, its renewable resources is what's going to draw people, because that's our future, you know, after everything is gone. So our kids got to think of not only protecting issues now, but they also have to keep their eye on the future. What did they want for us to be?
Mm-hmm.
So,
and for a community in rural Alaska like Dillingham, and the, you know, the region where you grew up and, you know, where you have your ancestors are from, I mean, do you feel like what should people be keeping in mind? What's important about life in these places that you think they should be thinking about when they make the sorts of decisions that you're imagining that they're going to have to face?
Try that one more time.
So I was just wondering what you think are the most important things that the next generation should be keeping in mind about
mm-hmm.
life in a place like Dillingham
mm-hmm.
when they're facing these really complex decisions.
Oh, okay. You know, one of our biggest complaints, I think, about living in rural Alaska is the high cost of living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so as people try to address that issue, finding cheaper transportation and cheaper way of getting things in to lower that cost, and to find alternative energy sources. Once they accomplish that, Alaska is a growing state. Because it's such a small state now, but it just has a lure to it. It's an attraction. I mean, I can remember going to Japan and when I went to school over there, and Alaska, you're from Alaska, and they'd sit there, they'd want to talk to me, and oh, they want to go to Alaska. Everybody wanted to come to Alaska. When I went to Hawaii, people wanted to come to Alaska. When I went to Washington, D.C., or Florida, or California, Alaska has that sense of wildness to it. It has that attractiveness to it. And people always talk about that Binky the polar bear. You know, you got to say that polar bear, you know. And so they look at Alaska, it's mystic, it has its own attractions, and eventually they're going to come. And they're going to stay. A lot of those folks are going to stay because they, wow, this is a great country. What other state gives you $1,000 to live in the state, you know? And so they're going to come and they're going to stay. And the population has grown. Just look at Anchorage. You know, I mean, back when I came here, when I first time I came here, I think there was less than 100,000 people here. Now there's 300,000 people, you know, maybe more, I don't know. I don't know what the latest count is. And in our region, in Dillingham, when I moved out of there in 63 to Oomsnoughly, there was less than 600 people. There was 500-something people, you know. And now there's 2,100 people. And I think the only thing that really kept them from growing was the land claims, because there wasn't any really open land. But now that the land has been settled, people know where federal land is, state land is, private land is, corporation land is. That land is gonna, some of that corporation, village, state land is all gonna go for sale, and people are gonna start settling on those lands. And so that's population growth. And so that's something that the people are gonna have to, because more people, that means more damage to the ecosystems around those communities, more runoff, more de-icing, more different ideas tried on some of these lakes. I mean, you look at how fragile this ecosystem is. One of these lakes, you know, used to have all these little fish in it, and somebody put pike in there, and all these little fish were gone on the back of her. You know, there's going to be a lot of invasive species. There's a lot of issues that people are, you know, don't realize with population growth is going to happen, because they forget that that sometimes they try to cure a problem. Like out there in Bristol Bay, we try to cut down the cost of living. And so we start looking at the airlines and the shipping companies. We invite them to come in earlier, invite them to come in late as they can in November. And then, of course, we're inviting airlines to come directly from Seattle and stuff, you know. And with that, there's, of course, there's going to be more tourism, and Princess Tours is going to be up here, and they're going to be running into state pretty soon. You know, if we don't gear up and start saying, okay, let's do something else. But there are big businesses out there just waiting to come into the state because of its newness, small population, but its attractiveness. They know it's going to draw people. But if we're not careful, if we don't do our long range planning, we're going to become overwhelmed.
And so any last thoughts that you might have on, in terms of that long range planning, based on your sort of perspective, looking back on what you've seen over the course of your life, you know, what people now and in the future should be thinking about most, in what's, you know, the most important things that the aspects of life in Bristol Bay that you've seen that you care about. What should, any last thoughts you have on how people should be thinking about this long-range planning that you describe?
Yeah, I think when we do long-range planning, we got to really lay out on the table of everything that we think that we really got to study. Some of the issues. I think about using the spruce bark beetle as an example that came in and devastated all our trees, you know. And supposedly it's a natural occurrence that happens, and so it leaves all these dry trees sitting in the forest, and you think that they're totally harmless, you know. They're just gonna. They're going to die, and they're going to fall over, and a new tree is going to sprout up. But you put that spruce bark tree on fire by lightning or by an accidental fire, and that thing is going to go. It is just something that's just going to burn up. And this last summer, we saw the results of that all across the state and all across the United States. The spruce bark beetle that killed all these trees and all these forests. And of course, we let the Wildlife Service said, oh, keep everything natural. But they never saw that spruce bark beetle tree was going to create havoc with fires and stuff. So when we do our planning, we got to look at all aspects of what might happen to changing the environment just a little bit, you know. And so then you tack on global warming and climate change and stuff like that. All of those have reactions somewhere down the line. It's either going to hurt you or make life better for you, you know. But you really got to, people really got to not rush over or bypass it, but take a look at all the things that are happening around us.
Okay. Well, thank you for all these perspectives. I want to just let you have the last word in terms of anything that you feel like you haven't mentioned that you feel like might be important thoughts on these topics for now and for people who might listen to this recording in the future.
No, just go out there and enjoy it. Be careful and have fun. That's what I say.
Sounds like a very good way to finish off. Thank you so much, Tom.
Yep.